I'm David Gibson, and I'm talking today with Dr. William D'Antonio at the Catholic University of America. He is a sociologist who is a fellow at the Life Cycle Institute, which is a center for the study of Catholic social thought and public policy. Dr. D'Antonio, yesterday, President Obama spoke at Notre Dame. Father Jenkins introduced him, and in Father Jenkins' remarks, he said, the world today is fixed on differences between people. He said that angry, hateful divisions between human beings are the challenge of this age. Do you agree with him? Is this the challenge of this age?
It certainly is one of the challenges. Actually, I've been studying a version of the challenges in the U.S. Congress going back to 1971. A colleague and I began to just probe what was going on in Congress, not with very clear ideas about what we would find. We now have data on all roll call votes in the U.S. Congress for the House and Senate going back to 1971, and we can almost pinpoint the point at which the conflict called polarization in the Congress, I mean, the word polarization has come into very popular usage, yes, to try to express this as really becoming manifest after 1980. Let me express it this way. In 1971, for which we have opening data, when we ran for a number of controls, including religion, only 34% of any single roll call vote could be identified with party. In other words, 34% of the times you could predict the vote on the basis of whether it was a Democratic Party issue or a Republican Party issue, and the party vote would decide the issue. A majority of Republicans voted for it, or a majority of Democrats voted against it, and they were in the dominating position. By post-1980, you begin to see an increasing percentage of votes being decided strictly along party lines, so that religion no longer mattered, region of the country no longer mattered, the particular nature of the issue no longer mattered. So that by 1994, post-94, the parties are simply locked into their ideological position. Now, it begins with, this is how we read the data right now. And I do have an article that I'll recommend to you, which is called Catholicism, Abortion, and the Incoming Polarization of the U.S. Congress. Before 1980, abortion was not a party issue. You could be a Republican senator for Texas, like Tower, and you would be pro-choice.
Yes.
You could be a Democratic senator from Delaware, like Biden, and you would be pro-life. Indeed, Ted Kennedy was pro-life. But the issue was not a party issue. It was a particular religious conscience issue. And then in 1976, when Carter and Ford were running against each other, the bishops, the U.S. Catholic bishops, who were the predominant voice, and you could not find the evangelicals in the battle, they were really going after Carter and did not see themselves as going after Ford. Ford was mildly pro-choice. Carter was known to be pro-life, but Carter said that the abortion issue had been made a constitutional issue through Roe v. Wade, and the bishops wanted him to lead a platform which would say that we must have a referendum on Roe v. Wade to get rid of it. He said that we wouldn't do that. So it was this kind of a struggle, and what happened was both parties have kind of squishy statements about the sanctity of life, but neither party came out on the issue of abortion very clearly. Because 1980, and Ronald Reagan, the most pro-choice governor in the history of any state in the country, passed the most pro-choice legislation in California, decided that it was time to bring the evangelicals into the Republican Party. So he sent a team of Bill Brock was the chairman of the Republican Party, and a little-known priest named Shea, Father Shea, whom I've since looked up. My God, the web tells you everything. I don't know if it was John Shea or what, but you can type it in, to meet with the evangelicals. And they had a dozen evangelicals meet under the leadership of Charles Moore, whose name might not be important to you because you're going to think of Jerry Falwell, but Moore was the executive director of the Moral Majority, and with money. And Moore brought the 12 together in a very quiet meeting, and Brock and Shea they already drafted a statement about abortion, wondering what would bring the evangelicals into the Republican Party. Well, there were three things that the evangelicals wanted. Strange enough, abortion was not first. First was rearming the military because Jimmy Carter was threatening the world peace and the domination by the Soviets by cutting the military budget, which the bishops supposedly support. And so you had to get money back into the military. Two, abortion, and three, lower taxes. Also, they demanded positions on all the key committees of the Republican Party, and they got them. And the adoption of the Republican platform opposing abortion and seeking the overthrow of Roe v. Wade takes place there, leaving all the pro-choice people and the Democrats struggling over the position that they were going to take. Of course, Carter was still opposed to abortion, and the plank talked about the sanctity of life, but the abortion, the Democratic Party began to move into the pro-choice position. And in other words, it was Reagan's decision to make abortion a key party of the anti-abortion, a key part of the Republican Party that began the split. Now, if you look at the American public, at all these public opinion polls that we have, you would find that most Americans on the abortion issue, there were 20% opposed to abortion under any and all conditions, there were 20% supporting abortion. And this has been true throughout most of the last 30 years. In the middle were the 40 or 50, I guess it was 18 and 17, so there's like 65% in the middle, some saying abortion in some conditions and another percentage saying abortion in most conditions. This is where the American people were. They don't necessarily see abortion as moral, but they see it as legal and that it ought to be there. So the public is in the middle. And so when we talk about polarization, it doesn't look like the public is polarized. But the public has two options when they go to the election. They don't opt for somebody who's sort of sometimes pro-choice. Mm-hmm. You either, the Republicans now are only supporting candidates who are pro-life. Now, I have a chart showing what happened. In 1980, a majority of the Republican senators were pro-choice, and a majority of the Democratic senators were pro-life because the majority were Catholics. By 1984, there are practically no pro-choice senators left in the Republican Party. And the Democratic percentage pro-choice is going up and reaches and has stabilized around 80%. The Republican percentage pro-choice is down to 2%.
Yes.
So now you see the polarization. Now the polarization moves from abortion to incorporate, suddenly same-sex marriage appears on the scene. And now, of course, the embryonic stem. So there's a cluster of positions. Homosexuality becomes seen more progressively by Democrats and less so by Republicans. And then that begins to define all the other issues. So that even David Broder in the Washington Post, after we've been publishing it, and as a matter of fact, now I don't have the article. The Washington Post published an article of ours in 2004 showing that the divide was becoming very real.
Yes.
So you get 95% of Republicans voting aye on one issue and 90% of the Democrats voting nay on the same issue. So that's where this clear polarization can be found in the Congress, despite the fact that the people may not be so polarized.
It seems to me that we have polarization on many levels in our society. We have polarization within the church, in fact, among the members of the church. We have polarization in local communities over all kinds of issues. People, it's as if sometimes there's a habit of polarization, or this is the way people relate today. And I think what Father Jenkins, the president of Notre Dame, was suggesting yesterday is we have to move beyond this habit, if that's an accurate word at all for it, that we have to find a new way to relate to each other. Now, are you suggesting, first of all, that the polarization we find on many levels has political roots? And then secondly, I'd just like to say, is how do we begin within the church or in any context to move beyond polarization?
Well, you probably know that I've been part of a series of surveys on American Catholics going back to 1987. And one of the questions that we have asked in each of what we now have four surveys is asking Catholics where they see the locus of moral authority in their lives. Should it lie within you, the individual? Should it lie with the hierarchy to tell you what the moral principles are that you should obey? Should it lie with dialogue between the hierarchy and the laity? Well, you're not surprised that there's a generational difference here all the way through. The older Catholics, pre-Vatican II Catholics, were consistently more likely, although never a majority, to say that the locus of moral authority should rest with the bishops. By the time you get to Vatican II Catholics, you see a clear majority saying the locus of moral authority rests with me as an individual, my conscience. I may listen to the bishops, but ultimately my conscience is the locus. And when we get down to the newer, youngest generation, and in our last study, the millennials appear, these young 18 to 25-year-olds, there's probably nobody who thinks that the moral authority should rest with the bishops. But the most interesting finding isn't that. I mean, you're not surprised in American society that conscience has a strong place. It is what happened among my generation over time, the pre-Vatican II generation. They went from a plurality, 40%, saying that the locus of moral authority should rest with the bishops, to the most recent survey where the largest plurality among them, 30%, said it should rest in dialogue. And dialogue has grown up within each of the groups, taking away from the ecclesiological top-down position. So what are the ladies saying? We want a dialogue. We want to talk about this. We want to talk about why divorce and remarriage within the church. We think that we see evidence from history and from Paul that tells us that you're going at it the wrong way, this punitive approach. We may even think that there's a case arguing for a child who's raped not having to bear this fetus. So Catholics want to talk about this. And especially the youngest ones say, if you don't want to talk about it, then you don't have anything to say to us. We're living in a society where the other variable that we can show is that increasingly percentages of Catholics are getting more and more education. I mean, we're no longer the immigrant church.
Yes.
The more education you get, the more you're likely to actually begin to think critically. Now, the interesting part of our data on education is the percentage of Catholics with higher education in Catholic schools turn out to become the most critical of the notion that they accept top-down authority. They really, I think, they say, we got taught to think critically. Reason means dialogue. And if they're going to teach us that in Catholic schools, we want to see it in the reality of our church life.
One of the things that Notre Dame's president said yesterday when he introduced President Obama, he talked about dialogue and the need to move into a time of dialogue, and he said that this means speaking with courtesy and with respect, and it means listening, and he said it does also mean speaking honestly. Now, I mean, what we saw at Notre Dame yesterday was a highly polarized position, a situation in which you had one side at the gates of the university vigorously protesting over the abortion issue, and another side inside the gates talking about abortion. I guess what I want to ask is, what would motivate people who have been polarized, what would motivate them to begin the dialogue? Why would they do this? I think they would fear that the dialogue was going to lead them to giving up something, ultimately making compromises on important points. What would motivate people to enter into dialogue when they haven't been doing this?
Well, I have two responses. One is that there have been some experiments with dialogue. There is a group in Massachusetts, and I have cited them in one or both of our recent books. Right after, it must be about 10 years now, an organization that seeks dialogue, I mean, that they're funded to bring people together, found five Catholic, I think they were all women in this dialogue, women totally opposed to abortion, complete supporters of the total church position, and five women who were pro-choice, strongly pro-choice. And they agreed to meet regularly over the next 5 years, away from and without talking about anything to the public, to just meet and see if they could talk, at least explain their position.
Yes.
And this took place in secret over, after 4.5 years, they had decided that they would make a public statement. It was published in the Boston Globe.
Mm-hmm.
And I might even have the article somewhere, but you could find it in the Globe. After this 4.5 years, the article written by the woman who was in charge of this organization said, not a single woman had changed their position, or not a single person, I can't guarantee it was all women, not a single person had changed their position. What had happened over the 4.5 years is that they developed a deep respect for each other. They came to understand the position of the other, not to accept it, but to understand how deeply held, and at least they understood the rationale that the other had, whether it was pro-choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Now, was something accomplished? I think something was accomplished. It shows that we may have in society, well, I think we have a lot of situations in society that are not reconcilable in the sense, well, I'll change my belief to your belief because, I think it will be better for us if I change my belief. No, you mustn't change your belief. What you have to do is to accept that some irreconcilable things happen in society. I mean, the world is so diverse. The notion that we're going to just all become one happy family. Come on. In my family, I have some irreconcilable Boston Red Sox fans who don't understand that the Yankees are the team we should be rooting for.
Right.
Right. What we do agree is we'll have a nice dinner together and shout a little bit.
Well, you meant you speaking about respect, and we're coming toward the end of this interview, the time for this interview, but Father Jenkins also spoke about the teaching of Vatican II, that Catholics are called to have respect for people who differ from them and who do believe things that are different than they believe. I'd just like to get very basic for a minute and ask you, what do you think the word respect means? What does it we use it a lot, but what does it really entail?
Well, for me, trying to understand it means that I'm willing to sit here and listen to you explain your position to me with the understanding that you're not going to walk out before you have a chance to hear me, and you're not going to condemn me at the end for what I believe.
Yes.
If I am willing to sit here and listen to what you believe and try to figure out whether, in fact, my beliefs are faulty, and in what way they may be faulty, and so that it requires this ability to listen, not to shout down, not to condemn, but to be respectful of it, not to use the kind of language that is used. I mean, to say that Governor Sebelius, now the Secretary of Health Education, is pro-abortion because she vetoed a bill that her lawyers told her was a defective bill and was unconstitutional. She was doing what, as governor, she should be doing, making the right decision, but we're calling her pro-abortion. I'd like to, as we're moving towards the end here, go back to Vatican II and to Lumen Gentium, the light of the world.
Right.
Chapter 12 in Lumen Gentium has an interesting passage. It says, and we quote it in every book we publish now because people need to remember this, the church will never err when all of its members, from the Pope down to the simplest member of the laity, are at one on an issue. We are clearly not at one on the birth control issue. We're clearly not at one on the abortion issue, or on divorce and remarriage, or on homosexuality. And we won't become at one until all of us are part of the secret.
Until
one of the things that the bishops do to us is they say, the church teaches. Well, are we part of the church or not? Vatican II says we're part of the church. Baptism makes us part of the church. I think
so. We'll never be one until we have dialogue and respect.
Yeah, and a top-down ecclesiology is defective by its very nature. It seems to me, at least as a sociologist, the reality, the lived experience of people. Finally, theologians are talking about the lived experience of people. Jesus always talked in terms of the lived experience of people. He forgives the woman caught in adultery. And he remembers, you know, any of you out there who's never committed any sin, throw the first rock, go ahead.
Yes.
That causes us to stop. And I think that's what Jenkins at his mesh yesterday was saying. Come on, you have to talk about it.
Yes.
And by the way, you have to give Notre Dame a lot of credit. When Father Hesburgh was still president, he allowed this to take place at Notre Dame, a parley on abortion.
Yes.
He said, you can't just oppose it, you got to talk about it. And Bernardine at its best, and he was mentioned yesterday, if we're going to close, let's close with Bernardine. When Bernardine gave his talk in December of 83, at Fordham, I believe it was, the first time he expressed the consistent life ethic, he said, we are prepared, we ought to have a public dialogue from conception to death on all of these issues.
Yes.
He believed that he had the strength and the Catholic position was strong enough to survive a public dialogue in the public square.
Yes.
Now, you know what happened. The number of cardinals from law down who said, whoops, get abortion off of that. That's not part of the dialogue.
Yes.
See? And it destroyed, it immediately polarized the thing and made impossible the opportunity. And I think that that's part of the tragedy of our time, that we did not heed Bernardine's strong feeling.
I think we have come to the end. We're coming right to the end of this recording, so perhaps we can continue this discussion. Thank you very much, Dr. D'Antonio.
Well, it's been fun.
Very helpful.
It's we live in exciting, very uncertain times. I did think my old age would be a little less exciting, I must say.